It's always at times of great sadness that I try to reflect on things for which I am grateful. So I'll start with that first. I'm grateful that George Norrie is taking a night off and gave me an opportunity to come in and fill in on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And I'm grateful for all the people out there that friended me on Facebook. I've enjoyed reading your comments and following up in conversations with you all, as I will continue to do in the years ahead. And I've always enjoyed reading email, although, you know, we can't answer all of them. I sure try, so thank you. But I am sad. I'm sad for the loss we heard about yesterday. I'm sure you know about it by now, that Andrew Koenig, the son of Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov on Star Trek, was found dead. According to his father, he took his own life. Andrew Koenig actually was a kid I watched before, like a lot of people had, in Growing Pains. But here's a little bit more to that story, and that is, if you were listening last week on Coast to Coast, you may have heard us promote the fact that that Walter Koenig was going to be on with us in the first hour last Saturday night. He has a new movie out on DVD called Inalienable, which stars, amongst other people, his son, Andrew. And we were hours away from doing that show when we got the call that said that that Walter Koenig is experiencing a family tragedy. It wasn't the usual family emergency. It wasn't something that we might hear from time to time from a guest, but actually, you know, the words family tragedy, something really tragic. And not only would he not be available for Saturday night, that it may never be an interview that he'll ever follow up on ever. And we just didn't know what that meant. But, you know, of course, our hearts went out to him. We didn't talk about it much on Saturday. We didn't really know what to make of it. It sounded private. And it was a few hours after that cancellation, and we had filled in with some other guests in the first hour last Saturday. It was a couple hours after he'd gotten off the air before we heard the story about Andrew Koenig. We were going to have Chekhov on to talk about this new movie he had done and to reminisce a little bit about Star Trek and to promote tonight's appearance of Nicholas Meyer, which is a follow-up to the interview we had in a longer form earlier in the month with Nicholas Meyer, who has a book out as his autobiography, well, sort of a memoir. I don't know actually what the difference is between the two now that I think about it. But The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and A Life in Hollywood. And so the two shows were going to be connected, and we were going to talk about the show tonight on with the Chekhov. And it saddened us to hear that despite some glimmers of hope earlier in the week, that Walter Koenig had expressed the possibility that his son was alive and in Vancouver somewhere, that the police had some sightings, and that maybe, although he was depressed, he hadn't acted on that in any way. You know, we were cheering for him and the possibility that this could all have a happy ending. And so it is, though, that we express with great profound loss in our own sense, not having known the kid, that I think we can all relate to a father who struggled hard to try to save his son from himself. Anybody who's been down those roads of depression know how tricky that can be. And so it is that then we start the interview with Nicholas Meyer, just where that story ended off yesterday, having worked with Walter Koenig. I'll ask him to reflect on the work that he did with Chekhov before we get to where we wanted to go originally with tonight, and that is the discussion of the famous made-for-TV movie The Day After, which if you've seen of it, if you've heard of it, you know was a game changer, to use the modern cliche, for the Cold War, for the arms buildup, for President Reagan, for the country. And it all came in the form of an unlikely made-for-TV movie. And so we'll talk about that. It's one of the many projects that Nicholas Meyer directed in his life, including the Star Trek classic Wrath of Khan, and then later on a revisit with the undiscovered country. So we'll spend some more time with Nicholas Meyer. We'll start with his thoughts on Walter Koenig tonight, and then we'll move on to the day after, and we'll do open lines for the rest of this show. So I hope you enjoy it. Thanks, George. Hope you're enjoying your weekend off, and we'll get started next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Nicholas Meyer is the novelist, the writer, the director, and the producer that many people know best from the Star Trek series, but is also known by his many fans for other works, including the movie Time After Time, which we spoke about the last time he was on, and then later on, of course, working on The Day After, which we'll get to coming up in just a second. And for the true aficionados of Nicholas Meyer, nothing will ever be better than Invasion of the B-Girls, which, Nicholas, I just want to tell you, I have finished watching since we last spoke, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
I've never seen it.
That's what you say, but I'll send you my copy if you want it. I rather enjoyed it.
Well, I think the time has come for me to watch it. I think I'm old enough now to withstand it, and I confess I have a real curiosity about it because people have told me over many years, and I can't quite determine in what spirit they tell me that it's fun.
Yes.
I don't know if it's fun or it's camp or it's good or it's so bad it's good or something. But
it's,
I think,
all
the time
that
has come for me to watch it.
It's all that. And wrapped up in caramel and nougat, too. I mean, it's just, it's all folded into that. It's great. In fact, Invasion of the D-plus Girls, I think, might actually be a better title for the movie. But that's just me. I mean, there's a lot of that. I like that. But I don't understand why in some reissues it's titled Graveyard Tramps. I don't get that one.
I never heard of that.
Never heard that? According to the IMDb page, it was retitled and reissued as Graveyard Tramps.
Well, the original title, the title I wrote it under, it was called The Honey Factor.
It's yet to make an appearance under that, but it's not too late. So it's sad news about Walter Koenig and his family. And I know that you, too, have experienced loss in your life with your first wife from cancer. And that you struggled through that very difficult time. Your thoughts as you were following that story this week?
Well, I think, first of all, that in the face of tragedy of these dimensions, you learn the true paucity of language, that words really seem powerless to express anything meaningful at such times. There must be few things more horrible than to endure the death of a child. It just seems like that's something that's real hard to recover from. And one else has to speculate that if this death was indeed self-inflicted, that there is an element of reproach somewhere in all of this, that my dad once said that attempted suicide is a cry for help, but successful suicide is a declaration that help was not forthcoming. And I'm sure in Walter's case that it was not for lack of trying. I can only imagine the Herculean efforts that had gone into trying to save this young man's life. And my heart goes out to Walter and Judy and the rest of the family. I don't know how you put one foot in front of another after this.
Well, you write a little bit about that yourself after your wife died. This about the same time that Pierce Brosnan's wife died, too, of breast cancer, wasn't it?
Ovarian,
that's right.
Yeah, she had ovarian cancer.
And you talked about that you both had worked on the movie The Deceivers and had become friends there. And then you also kind of helped each other get through that period. And It sounded like a very interesting time, the way you described it, that you would both just get together regularly and share memories of your loss.
It wasn't just sharing memories of the loss. It was also sort of attempting to exchange sort of data on how you related to the present world. And when we both fell in love again, that was also something that we discussed as unlikely, as miraculous. Life does go on. It's like a train that simply won't stop, and people sometimes seem to fall off the train, or they do fall off the train, but the train doesn't stop. It just keeps on going. As long as you're alive, you're moving and things are happening, and it may be more appropriate and dramatic terms for somebody's life to end at a given moment, but most of the time it's not so convenient, it's not so neat, it's not so pat. You just keep on living, and while you're living, you got to find a reason for living, and if you're lucky, if you're really lucky, you do. But it is, and I remember that on occasion there were other widowers who would join us for lunch. It was sort of a melancholy thing, but I do remember one day when Pierce started to talk about his wife, and he began to weep, and I started to talk about my wife, and I began to weep. And at this point, a girl with rather large bazooms walked by, and both our eyes swiveled at the same time. At the girl with the bazooms, and then we sort of looked at each other, and we were sort of laughing and crying at the same time. And at that point, I thought, well, and he thought, well, maybe we're going to be okay somehow.
Right.
But that's different. I think that's different than what the Koenig family is going through right now.
But it kind of reminds you that old rabbinical expression, you know, a baby's cry is God's way of saying that life must go on.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Ever heard that? I think it's lovely. And that's sort of what you went through too, because you had two little girls, and you were filled with despair. And you even, I think in your book, you even reflect on even thinking maybe ending it yourself, but you just knew that those girls couldn't experience something like that twice.
Yes, I felt, and I also, I remember, you know, I sort of resented them at the time. I thought I had been blackmailed into staying alive, and now, you know, I can't thank them enough. You know, they saved my life, and the woman who became their mother and became my wife, Stephanie, they saved my life, and I am beholden to them.
Yeah.
Which is a little off topic, but there you go.
No, I think it's all on topic, and it's on, as you say, there's no real, we can't explain away the pain of what Walter Koenig is going through, or his wife is going through, or anybody in the family is going through, but we can at least understand in the context of the choices that we all face, and some of the ways in which it can inform the way in which we can respond to other people in pain, which is what I thought was interesting about the interview that he gave to the press almost immediately after the news came out about his son. And he just used that as a teaching moment to say, reach out to people, reach out to somebody who's in depression, don't give up on them, fight for them. And I thought that was a very sweet and a very telling thing to do.
Courageous.
Very courageous. Yeah. And your career is filled with that kind of courage, and I want to get to a couple of moments about that. But before I do, tell the story about when you were working actually with the Chekhov character for Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, because you told the story the last time you were on the air, and I like how you had to deal with this, because you had Khan in The Wrath of Khan picking Chekhov up and recognizing him, or recognizing him when they land on the planet to go follow that beacon that signaled that there was life, and he says, "I know you." And you had a lot of Trekkies that were saying, no, in the original Star Trek episode that Khan was in, Chekhov hadn't joined the cast yet.
That is correct. It is correct that I was corrected by people who knew the show far better than I did or do, that it was impossible for Khan to have recognized Chekhov since Chekhov hadn't joined the crew. And my somewhat tongue-in-cheek answer to this was that the Enterprise was a very large ship, and that just because Chekhov doesn't appear on the bridge doesn't mean that he wasn't somewhere in the bowels of the ship. Having at one time or another sailed on the Queen Mary across the Atlantic, I can tell you that that ship held 3,000 passengers and 500 crew, and I bet most of the passengers did not meet most of the crew. So that was my sort of cop-out explanation for why I had randomly, I think at the time, taken Chekhov and put him in a confrontation with Khan.
But it worked beautifully, and it's one of the reasons why that movie works so well, too. All the pieces do fit, even if you have to kind of shave them a little bit.
I don't think even Ricardo remembered that he didn't know Chekhov.
You're
like, oh, yes, I remember you. I never forget the face.
when you were writing Wrath of Khan, which you are not credited for, but you go through in your book, The View from the Bridge, you go through the process of how you ended up shaping and writing a large part of Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you say, on a scale of 1 to 10, what was your level of Star Trek knowledge?
1.
Okay. Where would you rank now?
5.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
What is the really? What are you surprised by? Should be lower?
Yeah. No, I would have put you around a 7.
Uh-huh.
I would have, I mean, after having, in terms of getting, I don't mean knowledge in terms of like Star Trek trivia or what, you know, level the decks are named or whatever, but in terms of the understanding of the characters and of this kind of the overall, the narrative themes and the other, I would have put you higher.
I think I may have misunderstood your question because okay. I did think you were talking not about trivia, but what I'll call detail. Whereas if I understood you to be talking about those characters, that group, then yes, I would sort of put my knowledge somewhere around a 7, and for some of the other characters, maybe even a notch higher.
There you go. But you also are well known for the movie that we didn't get a chance to get to the last time you were on with us, and that was The Day After, which is a movie that you directed, but you didn't write.
Correct.
Which, as a writer, you know, right away, I like the fact that you could have a sense for what something could be that you didn't write, and you went to bat for it as hard as though you had written it.
True.
ABC had approached you to do this. It was intended to be a made-for-TV movie all along. This was not originally supposed to be a feature film that they moved onto television.
It was supposed to be a miniseries, which is to say it was supposed to be a two-night event.
But you shaped it in a way, and this is what I want to get to with The Day After. Describe for people who have never seen The Day After how it was pitched to you and what you resonated with right away on that.
Well, The Day After is a movie that pictures a nuclear exchange between the United States and the then Soviet Union and attempts to depict sort of what was going on immediately before, immediately during, and immediately after the missiles land in both countries. And it's all seen from the point of view of Lawrence, Kansas, Middle America, and the dead center of the United States, and what those people experienced.
And we'll talk about what it was like to get this movie made, which was a very interesting fight, but also what the purpose was of The Day After, and then what the actual effect was what we could call the day after the day after. And we'll do that coming up with Nicholas Meyer. We'll also reflect back on a couple of the other projects he's been involved with. Star Trek-wise, too, we didn't talk a lot about The Undiscovered Country the last time, and I wouldn't mind a few minutes on that. The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood, Nicholas Meyer. Then we'll do a couple hours of open lines at the end of the show. In for George Norrie tonight. This is Ian Punnett. In for George Norrie tonight. Coming up tomorrow night, we'll be talking about The Poisoner's Handbook. This is a book that takes us back to the time when poisons were everywhere. People were using them with impunity. And that forced essentially the birth of CSI labs. It compelled a city seeing some of its wealthiest patrons knocked off by greedy family members to reconsider whether or not anything could be done in these postmortems to detect whether or not poisons were being used. And so it is that the Poisoner's Handbook also began to tell us about how poisoned the environment was for the era, as they began to discover that people were being poisoned by a lot more than just, you know, impatient sons and daughters that wanted mom or dad to kick off so they could take the family fortune, or jealous spouses or whatever. That there were, they discovered that poisons were all throughout the environment. We're getting into, you know, all the soft tissues. We're finding exactly what we're going through today. In many cases, we're still being poisoned. We'll talk about The Poisoner's Handbook tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Nicholas Meyer, The View from the Bridge, the TV movie The Day After, I think still holds the record for the largest audience for a television movie. And we'll tell you why, about both the brutality of the movie, what they could show and what they couldn't, what ABC originally gave the green light to, and then how they originally changed their mind, the fight to make it be the movie that it still is. Coming up next with the man that was responsible for it, Nicholas Meyer, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Nicholas Meyer, The View from the Bridge. How has your book sold, by the way, Nick?
I'm not really sure, except I do know that a paperback edition is coming in August, so I guess it must have sold well enough.
Good. Glad to hear that. And although we talked primarily about the Star Trek pieces in it, and I would refer people back to their stream link to catch your first interview, and thank you for the follow-up on this. The Day After thing is really interesting to me, and for people who remember the original made-for-TV movie or have since seen it, because it really is a classic, the memories that you share about that movie are interesting, because it puts the reader right in the place where you as a director hated to be. You were made promises up front about your involvement in this because you never thought you would ever direct for TV. And you made them give you reassurances, which obviously they started to go back on later on. Can you talk about that?
Well, I went to have a meeting with an executive at ABC after I was shown the screenplay of the movie. I later found out that I was the fourth director to be offered the movie, and people kept turning it down. And I read it, and I sort of understood why people turned it down. I think the great paradox about the nuclear question is that since 1945, we have lived with the knowledge that it's possible for us to annihilate ourselves. And how do you live with that knowledge? And I think most of us live with it by ignoring it. Somewhere we know that there is a Damoclean sword dangling over our necks by a thread. But you can't really live that way, so we don't pay any attention to it except somewhere we all know. But the idea of sort of facing that head on and making a movie about it and dealing with it and who would watch it, I couldn't imagine. So I understood why other directors had turned it down. And when I read it, and it was originally planned as a as a 4-hour, two-part movie over two nights. And at the time, I was being psychoanalyzed, and I was lying on the couch and trying to rationalize my way out of not doing this movie for all the reasons I've just sort of enumerated. And my analyst, who never spoke, finally opened his mouth and said, "Well, I guess this is where we find out who you really are." And the moment the words were out of his mouth, I was very angry, because then I knew I would have to make the movie. And I'll get to that later. But anyway, I went in and met with them and said, "Okay, I can, you know, I'll do this movie. I don't think it will ever get on the air." And they laughed, "Ho, ho, ho. Oh, yes, it will." And I said, "Well, let me ask you something, because it seems to me that this script is really padded by about an hour. And I don't think anybody's going to tune in for night two of Armageddon anyway. Why don't we just do the whole thing as a 2-hour, one-night event and zap everybody between the eyes?" And the executive said, "Well, you're right about it being padded by an hour, but what you fail to understand is the economics of television movies. ABC doesn't expect to make any money on this movie, but there is a limit to how much we can afford to lose." And basically the hour of, you know, what you refer to as padding, basically represents advertising revenue that we need to defray the expense of making the movie. So if you break down those 4 hours and two nights, what you're really talking about is 90 minutes a night plus 30 minutes of advertising. So I said, okay, I understand now what you're saying. And eventually I went out and filmed the whole 3 hours of script, even the so-called padded parts. And, you know, we'll get to sort of what happened to that by and by. But I was absolutely persuaded that at the end of the day, the American public was simply not prepared, certainly the network-watching public, and there wasn't a lot of cable back then, for anything like this. I don't know if they were all watching Charlie's Angels or The Flying Nun or whatever, but this was a horse of a very, very different color. And while it may have been masquerading as a television movie of the week, it was something far different. I think it had originated in the mind of Brandon Stoddard, who was the president of ABC Circle Films. I think he saw The China Syndrome, the feature film with Michael Douglas, and he began to think, what if we would make a similar sort of topically pertinent film? And that was his original idea. But I don't think he or the producer of the movie, Bob Papazian, ever really anticipated what a controversial undertaking this was going to turn out to be. I corralled other people into making the movie with me. My cinematographer, Gain Rescher, who photographed The Wrath of Khan, I went to him and I said, "You know, I'd like you to do this nuclear movie." And he said, "Oh, gosh, no, I don't think so." And I said, "Well, you know, let's talk again, because I think this is where we find out who you really are."
Good line. Had you heard that before?
And I said, "Do you really mean that the one time that Hollywood is going to let you put your work in the service of your beliefs, that you're going to prefer to sit around and bitch at dinner tables about how hard things are in the world and how nobody can do anything about it, but if somebody's actually giving you the shot, you're not going to take it?" I met Jason Robards on an airplane going to New York, and I didn't have to twist his arm. We got into a conversation. "What are you doing?" And I told him, and his one sentence was, "Well, this beats signing petitions." So that's how he became involved. And it was very, very hard. It was very, very depressing. It was very, very scary to immerse yourself in the world of potential nuclear holocaust, to learn where the missiles were, how long it took them to travel, and the side effects of nuclear bombs if they didn't kill you outright, something called the electromagnetic pulse, capable of shorting out super-sensitive electronic devices, particularly those run by transistors. Because, you know, we all have these surge protectors, but you have an airburst of a nuclear weapon, and no surge protector is going to stop all those transistors from being blown. Right. So there were a lot of charming little details to learn. And then at a certain point, while we were preparing the script, the producer, Bob Papazian, said, well, now we have to go and visit standards and practices. And I said, what is that? Because I had never directed a movie for television before. And he said, well, standards and practices. And he described what they did. And I said, sensors. You've just described sensors. And he said, well, they call it standards and practices. I said, Bob, never mind what they call it. These are the sensors. And we were in the car already. We were driving over to have the meeting. And I am not the fastest thinker in the world, so we, you know, stopped at a couple of traffic lights before I said, you know, Bob, I think that if you were going to censor this script, maybe it should have been censored before it was offered to me to direct. And he said, well, this is the way it's always done. And I said, yeah, but there's something not quite right about it, is there? Because you showed me the script. I said, okay, I'll direct the script. And now I'm finding out that it's not the script. It's bait and switch. I don't think I can be bound by anything that happens in this meeting. And Bob was a giggler, so he giggled nervously. And we went into this meeting with people who never smiled. Oh, boy. And they started in. Now on page two, the patient refers to his Japanese doctor as Tojo. Well, we can't have that. I said, well, why can't you? And they said, well, because we will not knowingly insult a portion of our viewing public with a derogatory, you know, ethnic slur. And I said, did you ever use the word nigger in a movie? And they said, oh, no, we never did. And I said, wait a minute. Didn't you make a series called Roots? Didn't you make that television series? I saw that. And they said, nigger all the way through it. And they said, yes, but that was in context. And I said, well, what does that mean? That sounds like a corporate line in context. Does it mean it was about niggers? And so that's why we could say it? And they said, well, I'm very sorry, but this line about the Japanese doctor being called Tojo by his patient, that's out. And I said nothing. And then we go on, we work our way torturously through this then 3-hour script, and they talk about the scene where the girl has obviously, although it isn't shown or named, bought a diaphragm. That has to go out. Why does that have to go out? Oh, because we will not appear to be endorsing birth control. I said, come on, you're kidding. First of all, the girl later regrets that she used it, so it's clearly not endorsing birth control. And I said, didn't you ever make a movie about birth control? Didn't you do a teenage pregnancy movie? They said, yes. I said, well, there was diaphragms and all kinds of things mentioned. They go, I said, don't tell me. That was in context. So we worked our way through this whole thing. And then I went off and began to shoot the movie. And I ignored all their directives. I just shot what was in the script. And I don't know if it was 3 days or 5 days in when my producer, Bob Papazian, nervously called to me at Dailies and said, there's a phone call from Los Angeles for you. And so I went, and there was an ABC executive on the line, apoplectic. Nick, what are you doing? You shot the diaphragm sequence. I said, well, yeah, I did. I shot the movie that was offered me, but let me make this real easy for you. Why don't you fire me? He said, what? I said, fire me. I mean, you know, we're only a week out. You can replace me. You can replace Jason. He said, what? I said, well, if I leave, I think Jason will leave. But you can replace him. It's only a week. He's only shot a day and a half or something. And, you know, as for the cinematographer, get another cinematographer. What's the big deal? He said, I'll get back to you. So the next day, there's about 10 of them on a speakerphone. And they're saying, Nick, you know, as officers of the ABC Corporation, it's our fiduciary responsibility to tell you that this material cannot be in the finished film. I said, fine, you've told me. And yada, 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 yada. And so I went on and shot the movie. And at the end, none of those things were the things that got censored. They all stayed in because there was a much bigger issue going on, which was what the movie was depicting. And by this time, the conservative spectrum of the United States, led by William Buckley and Phyllis Schlafly, were running up and down the country saying that the sky was falling because we were depicting a nuclear war and its aftermath. And they were very, very alarmed, and they were alarming the rest of the country and giving us the kind of publicity that no amount of money could have purchased, while at the same time making the brass at ABC very, very nervous. But I finished shooting the movie. I edited the movie, and I remember on the first day of editing the movie, I finished a scene, and I said to my editor, who was also my editor from Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, I said, fine, let's put this to bed and move on to the next. And he said, well, you can't put it to bed and move on to the next. And I said, why not? And he said, because this scene is too short. You have to cut things to length for television. And this really boggled me because I now remembered that I had told them originally the screenplay was too long. And here we were being confronted with the fact of that extra length. And I thought about it, and I said, just a minute. And I called up the ABC executive who was in charge of this movie. And I said, listen, can I just edit the movie the best way I know how and show it to you? And then if you want me to put stuff back in to fill it out to length, we can do that. But won't you let me put my best foot forward on this thing? Because I'm not really used to cutting things to length. I never did a movie for television. So he said, I'll get back to you. And they're always getting back to me. And the next day I got a phone call, and they said, we too believe in the doctrine of first impressions. Cut the movie any way you like and show it to us. What he didn't tell me was that by this point, because of Buckley and Phyllis Schlafly and various other conservative constituencies, all the sponsors for the movie had bailed. General Foods, General Motors, General Mills, all the generals had hit the road. Mm-hmm. So it now no longer made any difference how long the movie was. In fact, it was probably better if it was shorter because they'd lose less money. Mm. And that's how I came to get to edit the movie my way, or at least that's until they saw it, which we'll probably discuss after the break.
Well, I think that's the important piece, too, to this is once they saw the movie as you edited it the day after and they saw the power of this, what did ABC decide had to go? What could stay? And then, most importantly, what was the effect of this explosive, if you'll pardon the term, TV movie? How did it change the history that we still enjoy to this day? That is to say, how has this movie, the day after, helped us never live in a world that is in the midst of being in the day after. We'll tell you next on Coast to Coast with Nicholas Meyer, The View from the Bridge, and a little bit more about Star Trek II next hour. This is Ian Punnett.